and welcome to Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin, and I'm delighted to be speaking to an old friend with a brand new book. Deborah Muggart has been described as the Nora Ephron of North London. Reviewers say she is the princess of the deliciously dark, always funny, perceptive and very contemporary, the queen of social comedy, who's on top form in her latest work, The Black Dress. Debbie, we're sitting in your beautiful garden on the south coast, and a lot of these towns around here are characterised by the fact that they've got lots of charity shops and also ladies of a certain age. And that really is the starting point for your new book, which begins with this wonderful find in a charity shop.
Well, the heroine, Prue, who's 70 and dumped by her husband and rather desperate, she goes down to Deal, where I live for the day, and sees a little black dress in a charity shop. This triggers an idea in her, an idea so bold and reckless, really, that it takes her breath away, but she decides to go through with it. And in fiction, you can always push a character that bit further than one would in real life. I would never do this. So what she plans to do, it is also triggered, this idea, by her going to the funeral of somebody she doesn't know by mistake, because she arrives half an hour early at Golders Green Crematorium. They run a very tight ship there, in and out in half an hour. So she finds herself in the wrong funeral, and somebody says, one of the other people, "I don't know anybody here, do you?" Because, of course, in funerals, people come out of the woodwork from all parts of your life, and we all have many different personalities by the time we die and have had different lives. So she decides, because, as I said, she's dumped by her husband and is desperate for a man. She's ashamed of herself for being so helpless, but she is. She decides to get dressed up, to look in the local paper for I'm laughing at my own joke, look in the local paper for forthcoming funerals of women of her age, and then gatecrash, get the little black dress on, gatecrash the funeral, and try to get first dibs on the grieving widower. Because, as we all know, when a man is bereaved, women crawl out of the woodwork again, crawling out of the woodwork, to offer condolences and casseroles, and they say things like, "My car's making a funny noise. Could you possibly help?" Men are surrounded by women when their wives die. And that's a bald fact. It doesn't often happen the other way around. So Prudence decides to do that. And she thinks she's doing it as a sort of dare to herself. The whole thing, she thinks, is a kind of joke. But it's kind of not a joke. Because, as I said, she is shamefully desperate. So she gatecrashes. She finds a funeral and goes to it, pretending to have known the woman who's died, meets the grieving widow, who turns out actually to be rather a dish, rather attractive. She's struck lucky. And, of course, the man asks her, you know, "How did you know Susan," his wife? And she says, "Oh, we were at nursing school together," which is a complete lie. She's not a nurse, but she knew that Susan had been a nurse. So she finds herself getting enmeshed in lies as well. And then things go disastrously wrong in a darker and more dramatic way. But that's the premise of the book. That's the premise of The Black Dress.
And it works absolutely beautifully. I mean, that there are all these wonderful sort of strands that come together. There's, at one point, I love the description of the nosy neighbour.
Pam lives opposite, and nothing escapes Pam. She wants to be friends with Prudence, because one of the things that happens when you're on your own, because I'm sort of on my own at the same age, having come out of a marriage, is that you become, you know, one of these solitary women who sometimes, if you're in a married couple, you let sort of slip through the cracks, you forget about them. And Pam was one of these that Prudence and her husband certainly forgot about, because she's a frightful bore as much as anything else, and very nosy, and notices who's dropping wrappers on the pavement and whose children are coming in late, and adolescent children and stuff like that. So Pam sticks herself like glue to Prudence, who has to try and escape her, which is another reason her life turns in another direction, because to escape Pam, she has to go through the back of her garden rather than the front door. And it's at the back of her garden that something happens in the alleyway that then propels her to actually meet somebody else who changes her life.
And, of course, I mean, it highlights so many things that women of 70, and indeed any woman who finds herself single, it highlights so many of those issues that women like that face. So, for instance, as you say, people slip through the cracks, and people are also often, I think, ignored by their friends who are couples. There's something threatening about a woman on her own.
I think there is, and people don't realise that it's very hurtful. For instance, if you're going around with a couple who are married, A, they've got to not be too affectionate with each other because it makes you feel left out, obviously, you know, being gooseberry and stuff. And they always stick you in the back of their car and things like that. And that's perfectly natural. I did exactly the same thing. But I think that one has to be sensitive to the fact that somebody's on their own and they may feel lonely. I mean, I love being on my own in many, many ways, but I do get terrible couple envy, you know, when I see couples chatting away who've been married for years and years and trotting off to buy their statins together, hand in hand. I think, lucky old them, even though they might be a bit long in the tooth. And I think it's a great achievement to be married for, you know, 40 years and still find each other interesting. I know very few people who actually I would envy the marriage of, but I still suffer from marriage envy, because I do know some people who still find huge pleasure in each other's company. They always have, and they've struck lucky. You know, I've had a couple of marriages and two long relationships, and they've been great in many, many ways, but they haven't lasted. That's a short fuse, actually.
Do you think that's natural? Do you think that really perhaps relationships aren't meant to last over a sort of 7 or 10 year cycle?
Yeah, totally. Unless you're really lucky. Because, you know, in the old days, A, we would have died. Obviously, lives were much shorter. And B, we had a much lower expectation of marriage, or a more practical one. You'd have a lot of other friends. You would not weigh your unfortunate spouse with all these expectations. You know, it's difficult, particularly for men, actually. I think it's difficult. They've got to be, you know, sexy and sensitive and supportive, but yet not patriarchal and, you know, not put a foot wrong. Difficult. Mm. So, you know, the sort of vocabulary of dissatisfaction in relationships is a sort of 20th century thing. I don't think it really existed before that. Mm. You made your bed and lay on it. You had a big family, you probably hardly saw your spouse. You know, you had different lives often. So it's different. It's very different now, where we have to be sort of everything to each other. And that's a big burden for anybody, I think. And I haven't quite managed it, but I've had a good time on the way and happy times. And, you know, I wouldn't have missed any of it for the world, but they haven't all worked out in the end.
Mm. So with your four big relationships in your life, how have you seen them evolve? Would you characterise each as a completely different kind of relationship? Have you evolved along the way?
Isn't that interesting? Gosh, I've thought of that, but I haven't sort of voiced it. I'm trying to think. I think that, I mean, one of the things about funerals is that you have people, as I was saying, from different parts of your life when you've been a slightly different person. And the same with relationships. One is a slightly different person with each opposite number, and they bring out a different you, and you also learn different things, and they've brought a whole new different world into your life and you into theirs. So you have a sort of longer life, because you've had these, it's like going on holiday to three different destinations rather than one. You feel you've been away forever. So I feel your life is a bit longer. And one does learn, but not nearly enough. I've not learned much at all. I'm just as foolish and make just as many mistakes as before. I haven't settled down at all in my head. And I think, in a way, the success of the best exotic marigold hotel was that it recognised that we are the same person we always were. You know, we may have changed a bit, but actually, you know, the same loves, jealousies, resentments, joys, everything. We're just a bit more wrinkly. And it didn't look at old age in terms of incipient death and dementia and strokes, although they were sort of present, but that wasn't the point of the film. The point of the film was you can give yourself another go at an experience, love, India, whatever experience that might be. And I think that's why it struck a chord, because that hadn't been said. And I think it slightly changed the landscape, actually, and the way we think about old age, because there's an awful lot of us who are getting old, and we're living an awful lot longer, because when we get ill, modern medicine hauls us back again.
And so for Prudence, of course, this is exactly the same. She is still wanting companionship. She's still wanting love. She is everything she was at 17, but she's 70.
Exactly. And she's got a best friend, Azra, who's sort of tattooed and wears silver trainers and is bisexual and lives above a kebab shop and everything. She's much wilder. And she's living the life that somebody would live as a teenager and hasn't let age stop her doing anything at all. I mean, she's slightly annoying in that way because she's rather sort of bossy and difficult, but she doesn't behave like an old person. And you could say that my generation is reinventing old age as we go along. Joanna Lumley said something like, we're the guinea pig that a python has swallowed, you know, and the guinea pig is going down the python's body. You can sort of see us getting older and older and changing it as we go along in a sort of maybe sort of ab fabby sort of way, perhaps. But I think probably people have always been like that. We just, when we're young, we look at old people and think that they're past it, and with their grey-haired old people knitting or doing whatever they're supposed to do, you know, which isn't the case.
Menopause is a really interesting transition in our lives, in the lives of women. And I see so many marriages break up because a woman has hit menopause. And I think, I mean, a lot of people, certainly I questioned it, and I realised, in fact, I had always just been a bitch. It wasn't anything hormonal. But I look at a lot of marriages and see that actually it is about that fundamental change in our hormone levels. And I wonder if it really is that, or if women just come to this point in a marriage where it's enough now.
I sort of think 12 years is, 10 to 12 years seems to be enough with one other person. But the menopause thing is really interesting because people never talked about it. It wasn't that it was sort of grubby or anything. It's just people weren't interested in it or recognise it. But it's very traumatic. It's very traumatic. And also, it can make you go a little bit mad and painful and all sorts of things. And it's telling you, of course, that your fecund days are over and you're in another stage of life. I think it's rather liberating, actually, you know, for obvious reasons. But it's talked about now and much, much more, and I think that's fantastic. There are all sorts of programmes about it now. And I know many women who've suffered hugely, and they didn't really know why. I had a terrible time, and I'm not usually like that at all. So I think it's a good thing, really.
And another thing I notice about postmenopausal women is what I'm going to call late-onset lesbianism.
Well, I mean, I think it'd be jolly good idea. I'd love to fall in love with a woman. And I know several people who are hugely happy having been in marriages and everything, but now they're with a woman. I mean, it would be great. I mean, I don't know any that I've, you know, can imagine yet, but maybe one will come along. It'd be lovely. Because, I mean, most lesbian couples I know have a rare good time. They're always laughing. I mean, I may be romanticising it too much, but they seem to have a pretty good time because they think the same. Mm. They're the same sex. You know, there's a huge difference in one's interests.
Mm. Debbie, this book is what number of yours?
I think it's 21 or 22. It's an awful lot. Honestly, I look back at the list of all my other novels. It's extraordinary. I can't believe Well, it's like the thing about funerals. You know, somebody else seemed to have written some of those novels. Can't remember who she was.
Is it a different birthing process, if you like, for each one?
Yeah. Some of them start with things I see in the street, or Tulip Fever started with me buying a Dutch painting. The Best Exotic started with me thinking about what's going to happen to us when we're old, who's going to pay for us and look after us. So that was a sort of big demographic sociological thought, rather than seeing a woman in the street or a man in the street. Some spring up from... One or two have come from short stories that I've written, and then the characters in the short stories have refused to leave the party. You know, I've metaphorically come down in the morning and found them still, you know, smoking the fag ends and things, and so I've written whole novels for them because they just haven't left my head. And that's a good sign because it shows that they've got life to them. So they all come different ways, and sometimes they start with a character. The character tells me the story. I wrote one called Porky a long time ago, before anyone talked about child abuse and incest, which seems inconceivable now, but in the early 80s people didn't. That's when I wrote it. And that just came from driving past a bungalow on the A40, and in my mind's eye, a sort of bungalow that had, it was small holding, it had sort of one of those sort of lorry carcasses with pigs in it, you know, in the mud and chickens and stuff. And I saw this young woman stepping out of this bungalow in an air hostess uniform. And the whole plot came to me by the time I'd driven to London pretty well. And I sat down and wrote the book from the young girl's point of view and set it near Heathrow Airport in that sort of no man's land around the airport, about a young girl who had to escape her father by becoming an air hostess and flying off to Pakistan, as it turned out.
And do your protagonists get older with you? Are you ageing with your characters?
Totally, because I'm looking up my old short stories, because I've got to have a collection out next year of short stories. And these are ones I've written years ago. And strangely enough, I mean, lots of them are about, you know, airline pilots, or they don't have to be about women like me at all. But the ones that are about sort of middle-class women, they've got tiny children, and then the children seem to get a bit older, funnily enough, and then they've now ended up as women in their 70s. Mm. So, yes, they've grown up with me, but I don't always write about people like me. You know, I write about people who are not like me at all.
I find that extraordinary. I mean, you have male protagonists. You have such a huge bandwidth, if you like.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm not a sort of particular women's writer. I'm slightly labelled as one, but I've not. Yes, I've had novels which, I mean, the novel I'm writing now is about a security guard, of a 50-year-old male security guard who, you know, he's got nothing in common with me at all. That's what fiction does, and that's the great thing about it. But I'm slightly labelled that sort of, you know, middle-class, middle-brow writer, which I don't think I am particularly at all. But I can't complain, because, you know, whiny writers are not a pleasant sight, because we have an amazing life if we can get away with it. All the writers I know think that somebody's going to come and feel our collar and say, do you really think you can get away with making up things and presuming people are going to pay for them? You know, it's an extraordinary thing.
But it does seem to me that you have been treated completely differently as a novelist because you are a woman. There are a lot of men who are writing similar themes and books whose public perception of them is entirely different.
Yes, it is true. And it's not really fair. And a lot of male writers, quite, you know, lauded male writers, if you strip away their name, they will be writing quite novelettish, you know, women's magazine-y novels, actually. But, you know, they're rather grand. I think men, a lot of male writers take themselves pretty seriously, and then the world takes them pretty seriously. I don't take myself very seriously, you see. But I take the work seriously. I mean, Stephen Frears, the film director, he says, I take my work seriously, but not myself, and that's what I do. But if you take yourself seriously as well, and there are many, many examples of writers who take themselves jolly seriously, you know, other people take you at your word. Yeah. Naming no names.
The book before this one, The Carer, was about that generation that's just trapped between their elderly parents and their children, and just how difficult it is. But of course, again, you had this wonderful character who was so unlike you, who swoops in to take care of the father.
Yes, that's Mandy from Solihull. Yes, the old boy James, in his 80s, his two children are too busy having unsuccessful love affairs and doing their terrible paintings and writing their unreadable novels to look after him. So they employ Mandy from Solihull, who comes down with her in her trusty Fiat Panda with her marigold gloves and sorts out the old boy and gets him interested in doing scratch cards and all sorts of stuff, which he's never done before. It's the sort of thing about class as much as anything else. And he, in a way, sort of regresses. But he has more fun with her than he has with his own children. And the children have very mixed feelings about her, partly because they think she's delving into his financial affairs a bit too much. His filing cabinet seems to be left open where his will is. But more profoundly, because they feel guilty that they're not looking after themselves. They feel terribly grateful she's doing it. They feel jealous that their father seems to be having, as I said, rather a good time with Mandy. It's always in hoots of laughter with her. And they go off to, you know, Bicester Village retail outlets together and all sorts of things that he never... I mean, he's a professor of physics, you know. So they have all that. And he becomes Mandy's creature. And I noticed that when my mother got dementia and we had carers looking after her, living with her. And she became their creature. And she started being dressed differently. And I don't know if she did scratch cards, but different sort of occupations. And, you know, we felt very guilty that none of us, there were, you know, three of us daughters, and none of us actually looked after her full time at all. I lived opposite her, and we still employed carers to look after her because I couldn't do it. It wasn't in my skill set to look after somebody. And these people, as we know, underpaid, salt of the earth, you know, take all this off our hands. And obviously in the last year and a half, we've seen that writ very, very large, and we've all clapped for them. And I hope that that has sunk in because, you know, they are the support system, really.
Absolutely. Prue in black dress isn't at that stage. She doesn't need looking after, but she does need some kind of emotional shepherding, and that's what she's looking for. And obviously we don't want to give away how it ends or what happens to her, but she is on a positive trajectory.
She's, well, I'm trying to think how positive it is, really. She needs emotional support. She also needs somebody to fix her computer and, you know, tell her what's wrong with the car. She needs a lot of the traditional male things that one misses. And just the normal stuff of having somebody in the house stirring the air and making it different when you come into a room because they're there, and laughing at the Today programme or sneering at a cabinet minister who's talking absolute rubbish, or answering the door when you're sitting on the loo. You know, you say, can you answer the door? And there's somebody there to actually answer the door. You know, or take the dog out and do all the stuff that couples do. She misses all that. You know, however problematic the relationship was with her husband, they did that for each other. And it was quite a sort of traditional marriage in that way. Obviously, it doesn't matter which one of you does cars and computers and things, but she just misses it. And, you know, I can feel that. I mean, I've got lovely family living nearby and they can come and do things when I need them. But, you know, you need somebody to help just getting through all the mechanics of life, I find, because it's very complicated, you know, the simple admin, let alone anything else.
So would you like another partner?
I'd love another partner, yes, of either sex. But if I don't have one, I can manage pretty well on my own. But I think exploring that question that you're asking is really interesting at my stage in life, because the opportunities are much less of another partner, probably, just because one's much older, basically.
So shall we end this with a sort of, I don't want to say lonely hearts, because I don't think you're particularly lonely, but let's call it a dating ad. So as I said at the beginning, we're sitting here in your in your garden. It's fecund, it's vibrant, it's throbbing with life, as are you, as is your imagination. And so if you were to find someone perfect to complement that, who indeed might be listening to this programme right now, who would it be?
It'll be somebody who makes me laugh, obviously. That's the basis, really. Just somebody I can natter to. I just like somebody to just chatter to. And because I live by the sea, since lockdown ended, I've had people coming to stay, and I've just been sitting here talking to them all the time. It's been an absolute hoot. I love it. So a chatty man, nice chatty man, or chatty woman, don't mind actually. Now,
who publishes Black Dress?
Tinder.
There you have it. Well, that's how you get in touch with Debbie. The Black Dress by Deborah Muggar is published by Tinder and is out now. You've been listening to Monica Reads, produced by Nora Hull and presented by me, Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening.